as follows. So we use this expansion. We put it into the basic vector boson action, generalized to 5 dimensions, and made generally coordinate. And what we get out of this is a set of solutions for the FNs. And we solve for the FNs by solving this differential equation. And what you end up getting after applying the Neumann boundary conditions is, first of all, there's a zero eigenvalue, a zero mode. And that zero mode corresponds to having a zero KK mass here. And this piece, to solve this is straightforward. It just becomes a straightforward homogeneous equation. And it turns out that once you apply the Neumann boundary conditions, the only zero mode solution is just a constant profile, which we take this constant profile, and then we make sure it's orthonormal, or it's normalized in the sense that when we integrate it, we square it, integrate it over the interval with this weight, we get 1 back. So this is a normalization condition. So in fact, this constant, when you compute it, just turns out to be 1 over L0 log L1 over L0 squared. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. But we find a flat profile zero mode along here. But next, we can go on and solve this for non-zero MN squared. And it turns out that the solutions are related to Bessel functions. The solutions for non-zero FN, and you'll get to work this out in the homework, are some normalization factor for each N mode, a factor of this, and then Bessel functions of the first order. Oops. And then there's a beta n here. So the solutions are Bessel functions, and I have two independent things. It's like the standard solution where you have sines and cosines being independent. Here I have the j1s and y1s. And okay, so you may not have seen these in a while, but I have some review of them in my notes. And this nn is an overall normalization factor, and this beta n is just a relative normalization between these two pieces. So we take this, and we apply the Neumann boundary condition, Neumann boundary conditions at both ends. And it turns out that Bessel functions satisfy nice recursion relations. And roughly, when you take the derivative of a combination of z times j1 of z, you get back basically j0 of z. And same for y1. So it turns out that the boundary condition applied to z at L0 gives a condition that beta n is equal to minus j0 mn of L0 over y0 mn of L0. And j0 and y0 are fairly simple. And it turns out that this just simplifies into pi over 2 divided by gamma minus log mn L0 over 2, where this gamma is the Euler constant. I think it's like 0.7 or so. So in any case, our relative factors are given by this. So we have some, if you like, order one relative factor. The next thing we get to, though, is this is z equals L0. We also have to apply a boundary condition at z equals L1. And the boundary condition at z equals L1 turns out to give beta n is equal to minus j0 of mn of L1 over y0 of mn of L1. So we have these two conditions. And in general, to solve them simultaneously, we can only do so for certain values of mn. So finding these values of mn is a little bit like what you do for a finite square well, where you have, if you remember in quantum mechanics, the finite square well, you have sort of tangents that meet a straight line. If you think back to quantum mechanics. So you can do a similar story here. So you can plot this function as a function of mn, starting from 0 and increasing. And you can plot this function as a function of mn and starting and increasing. And what it turns out to give you is that roughly, these MNs turned out to correspond approximately to zeros of the J0. So a pretty good approximation. So this is something you have to solve numerically, but in the limit of M becoming somewhat larger than 1, the MNs correspond roughly to zeros of the Bessel function. And what you get at the end of the day for MN is the MNs are roughly, for N somewhat bigger than 1, pi over L0, N minus 1/4. So this is N much, much greater than 1, and L1 much, much greater than L0. And our normalization factors turn out to be something like MN root L0 over N minus 1/4. So these exact forms are not super, super important, except I want to mention two properties. The normalization isn't so interesting at the moment, but the important thing is that if we look at these KK masses, the KK masses end up looking like 1 over L1 with a linear spacing between them. So this means that our KK spacing is near the TEV scale. So recall that this L0 corresponds to 1 over the curvature K, which is roughly 1 over our fundamental scale, which we identify roughly with the Planck scale. Because we had this relation, M Planck squared is roughly M star cubed over K, and we expect K and M star cubed to be about the same size. So roughly, this stuff, L0 goes like 1 over M Planck to within a factor of a few, whereas the scale over here is this L1 corresponds to L0 with e to the pi KRC because of the warp factor. And we want this to be order inverse TEV. So the upshot of the story is that our KK masses are evenly spaced. So we have a zero mode at zero. But our KK modes are evenly spaced, and the spacing between them is on the order of a TEV. So this KK spectrum is a fair bit different from large extra dimensions. Remember, in large extra dimensions, we had lots of KK modes, at least for the graviton, that they were all very closely spaced, and their spacing tended to be much, much less than the weak scale. Whereas here, we find that our KK modes within this geometry have masses near the TEV scale and roughly even spacing. Now, one other thing we can do is look at the asymptotic forms with these relative normalization factors and see how the profiles of the KK modes lie in the extra dimension. So in other words, this is our four-dimensional KK field expansion. Its four-dimensional mass corresponds to MN. And this is a profile in the extra dimension. Sometimes we call these wave functions. They're not really wave functions, but it's a terminology. And if you look at the asymptotic forms of Bessel functions, and you use the fact that L1 is much, much bigger than L0 by assumption, by construction, what you find is that the FNs of Z looks roughly like something that grows going towards the IR. And so when I write oscillation here, I mean something that goes like a sine or a cosine. And the picture of this is at small z. So at z approaching L0, and here's L1, close to L0, we have, there's that arrow, close to L0. Close to L0, this is a negative constant, and it's a fairly small negative constant. If you put in the various things, so the wave function over here is very small, but going towards the to the IR brain, it increases as root z, and it oscillates a bit. So it has an increasing amplitude, and then it has some kind of flat tangent. So the point of this is that most of the, okay, so this isn't to scale, but most of the weight of the function lies towards the IR, whereas the amplitude of the profile is very small down here. And in general, the more ends you have, the more oscillates and so on. But this is the general picture. So these KK modes are also, we say, primarily localized towards the IR, in the sense that the amplitude near the UV brain is small, and the amplitude near the IR brain is growing. So this is for the non-zero KK modes. For the zero mode, recall, we just have a flat profile that's the same everywhere. So that flat profile lives evenly throughout the extra dimension, whereas the KK modes are mostly IR localized. OK, so just a couple of other comments. We applied Neumann boundary conditions, but we can also consider other boundary conditions. And these can be consistent with the action principle. And for example, it's not hard to show that if you have Dirichlet boundary conditions on both sides, you get similar KK mode solutions. They're off by a phase. But for the zero mode disappears entirely. And something similar happens if you have Neumann and Dirichlet or mixed boundary conditions. So the story here with these mixed boundary conditions is that you don't get a zero mode, and that means you don't have a massless vector boson state to identify with a massless gauge boson. And this has an interesting connection with Technicolor, but what it's saying is that you have you're effectively breaking the gauge symmetry in a way from the boundary conditions. So even though you wrote down a vector field and it has a nice five-dimensional local gauge invariance, you have something that doesn't quite work on the brains. So this can still be consistent. There's a way to interpret this as a spontaneous breaking, but it's a little bit cryptic, and I don't want to go too far into it. In any case, this is a story for a vector boson. And I started with a vector boson because the vector boson story, in some ways, is the easiest. The next thing I want to move on to is a graviton. And the graviton story is more complicated, but I just want to summarize the main results. For now, if you recall what we did in large extra dimensions, we expanded out the metric and fluctuations. And we found that we had various components. We had pieces that looked like we had an HMN, and then we decompose this into things that look like H mu nu, H mu a, and HAB. So under four-dimensional Lorentz, this is a two-component symmetric tensor, so it looks like a spin 2 object. This looks like a vector, and this looks like a scalar. Now, not all of these things were relevant in that most of them, including most of the components of this, and all the components of this, decouple completely, and that they didn't have any coupling to the standard model. Their only coupling would be gravitational, and that means we can essentially ignore them. They're not going to be relevant for particle physics, the particle physics we care about. So we're going to focus on this. There is one subset of this, if you call it, corresponded to the trace, HAA, and that we call that thing the radion. And I'm going to ignore this for now, but I'll come back to it a little bit later. So I'm going to focus on this piece. So we have this h mu nu of x of z. And the way we deal with it is, so it necessarily travels in the bulk. The way we deal with this thing is we write down our five-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action. We expand out the action. We expand out our GMN around the flat space, which would be the So this GMN is just L0 over z squared, 8 mu nu. And then we have an expansion around it like so. So we're expanding around the flat background, or the would-be flat background. And we take this, we plug it in, and then we're going to KK expand this thing. So this KK expansion takes the following form. Again, just like before, gn of z, h mu nu of n of x. And we take this expansion. We look at the form of the effective quadratic terms in the Lagrangian that we get from the Einstein-Hilbert action from expanding this out. It goes through completely analogously to the vector case. But you have to be a little bit more careful. You have to worry about gravity covariant derivatives, and the Einstein-Hilbert action gets a bit complicated. So I'm not going to go through that, but I'm just going to quote the result. And it turns out that everything works out, and we get we diagonalize all the KK stuff, provided we satisfy the following conditions. L0 to L1. So it turns out that we get a slightly different orthogonality condition for these states. So instead of getting, so previously we had one factor of L0 over Z, now we have three. And our corresponding differential operator turns out to be Z over L0 cubed, del Z L0 over Z cubed, del Z, GN equals minus MN squared GN. So this is also a nice Sturm-Liouville operator. And we apply Neumann boundary conditions. And this differential operator with these boundary conditions turns out to get a set of complete eigenvalues. So that means that our expansion in this form is justified. And the solutions to these turn out to have a single zero mode. And our single zero mode turns out to be, in this case, again, a constant. And its normalization is roughly 2 over L0. Whereas our KK modes have a similar form to before. But now instead of J1s, I get J2s. And just like before, I applied the boundary conditions to this function. This fixes beta n. It gives me two relations for beta n at both boundaries. And when I match them up, I get a discrete set of mn's that solve the differential, that solve the system, that satisfy the boundary conditions. And the upshot is that at the end of the day, the mn's end up going like pi n over L1. So they correspond roughly to zeros of J2. And as n gets larger and larger, they increase roughly linearly. And they're of order 1 over L1. So again, they're evenly spaced. They're about TeV size, so TeV mass sized. And they end up looking a lot like our vector KK modes we had up here. But there is one important difference. And the one important difference is that our wave functions here, our KK wave functions, our KK profiles, are normalized with respect to this inner product, whereas our vector KK profiles are normalized with respect to this inner product. So if you want to compare how these two sets of profiles are localized, we should take into account the fact that they're normalized with respect to different inner products. And it turns out that the natural inner product to compare to, in a sense, is the one that comes up in the vector case. So what I mean by this is, suppose we could convert back to W coordinates. It turns out that integral 0 to pi RC dW corresponds to the integral from L1 to L1 dz L0 over z when you do the change of variables. And in this coordinate, there's no warp factor for the W coordinate. And this is, if you like, the kind of, in a sense, the flat thing to compare to. So this is a natural measure to compare to. And that means that our vector KK profiles are already normalized with respect to the flat measure. But our graviton KK profiles are normalized with respect to this different measure. So if you want to compare the graviton profiles to the vector profiles, we should normalize by this. And what this means in practice is that we should compare the vector profiles, fn of z, which have already, in some sense, a nice normalization, to a slightly a different normalization, which turns out to be L0 over Z, Gn of Z. And for example, if I look at the KK profiles, the KK profiles for the vector had a Z over L0 Bessel function. Whereas for the graviton, I have a Z over L0 squared times Bessel functions. So when I do this normalization for the KK profiles, they have a similar form. They have a Z over L0 factor times a Bessel function. And this gives them a roughly root Z increasing behavior going towards the IR. But the interesting thing is if I look at the zero modes. So for the zero mode, what we find is, remember we had F0 of Z is equal to constant. And we also had that G0 of Z is a constant. But the thing we really want to compare to is L0 over Z, G0 over Z. And this thing goes like 1 over Z. So in this picture, we see that our zero mode graviton, this is the massless state, and this is the state we identify with the graviton of GR, the graviton we all know and love. This is the state we identify with regular gravity, and we see that within this background, it's not just spread out evenly everywhere, but instead it's localized towards the UV. So it's localized more towards this side of the spacetime. And this is part of the reason why what we see is gravity looks so much smaller than the Planck scale. The reason why our local scale looks so much smaller than the Planck scale is that where we're sitting over here, gravity has a small overlap with us. So gravity likes to live over here. And the fact that gravity has a small overlap here means that the scale we see at this over here, the fundamental scale over here corresponds to a warped version of the scale over here. And this warping coincides with the localization of the graviton towards the UV. So in this sense, in this geometry, the fundamental scale where we are is pretty close to the TEV scale. It corresponds to the warp down value of the fundamental scale. But the reason we see gravity being so much weaker, the reason the apparent gravity scale is so much weaker than our fundamental scale near us, is that gravity is localized away from us. So it has a small overlap with us, assuming that we're living over here. Okay. So far we have gravity in the bulk. We've put vector bosons in the bulk. And the last thing I want to put into the bulk is fermions. Oops. So fermions are a little bit more complicated. So I'm not going to say too much about them. But I have a bit of a discussion in my notes. And the reason fermions are more complicated is twofold. I think you saw this in the tutorial yesterday. If you put a fermion in five dimensions, the five-dimensional representations of fermions, the smallest one turns out to correspond to a four-dimensional fermion, a four-component fermion in four dimensions. In other words, the smallest five-dimensional representation coincides with the Dirac fermion in four dimensions. And in four dimensions, a Dirac fermion is reducible into a pair of two-component fermion representations, whereas it's not reducible in the five-dimensional story. So as soon as we start putting fermions in the extra dimension, they seem to be non-chiral. But if we want to describe the fermions of the standard model, we want chiral fermions. We want a left-handed, let's say, a left-handed quark, but not, of course, a left-handed quark doublet, but not a right-handed quark doublet. So we're going to have to work a little bit harder to get to figure out how to get a chiral fermion from five-dimensional fermions. And you did some of this in the tutorial yesterday. The second thing we have to worry about is defining fermions in a warp background gets a little bit tricky. So the way we typically construct fermions is by looking at representations of basically the representations of Lorentz with respect to a locally flat background. So even in a warp background, at any single point in my space-time, I can define a tangent space. And that tangent space is locally flat. And I can define fermions with respect to that tangent space. But the problem that comes up is, OK, I can find fermions at one point in space-time, but I want to connect the fermion representation at one point to a fermion representation at a different point. So for that, there's a Veal-Bind formalism. There's something called a spin connection that describes how you connect your fermions at one point to another point. And there's a lot of there's a lot of formalism behind this. There's a lot of theory, and I don't have time to get into this. So I'm just going to basically quote the main result. And the main result is that our fermion action, when you take all this stuff into account self-consistently, is that you get integral d4x, integral L0 to L1, dz, psi bar. Psi bar is a four-component fermion. And the relative pieces are del z plus 2 minus c over z. I'll explain what z is in a second. So I get this plus a boundary term. So I'll just write the boundary term as follows. Okay. So this is what you get for the fermion action. And the C corresponds to writing a fermion mass term in my original action of the form m psi bar psi, just the usual thing you'd write, but re-expressing this m in terms of the fundamental scale and writing this m as C over L0. So C is the bulk fermion mass term that I put in my original Lagrangian, expressed in terms of 1 over L0 units. So I get these C factors here. So this picture looks a little bit like what you'd usually expect. And there's an L0. Sorry about this. There should be an L0 over Z factor here to the fourth. OK, so my fermion life is a little bit more complicated. This is a boundary condition. And I want this to vanish. So I want this to vanish and this to be my whole story, to get local equations of motion. And I also want to find a way to, in a sense, diagonalize this piece. So this thing looks a little bit like what I have for four-dimensional Dirac fermion. These pieces look like my gamma mu del mu. And these diagonal pieces with the C's, except for the 1 over Z factors, look a lot like what I typically get for mass term if I was to write it in terms of m psi bar psi. The new pieces I have, though, are these del Z's, these fifth dimensional derivatives. So we're going to have to work a little bit harder about this. And we're going to put KK expansions, separate KK expansions for the left and right-handed pieces of psi, and try to get boundary conditions such that the boundary term vanishes and this diagonalizes. So we're going to write the following KK expansions. Psi L of x of z is a sum on n fn L of z psi L of x. And actually, okay, I gotta fix that. Psi R x of z is some sum of n fn r of z psi n l. So this is the KK expansion that I'm going to try. And if I take this and I plug it in, what you get, if I take these and plug them in, and I want to diagonalize this piece, it turns out that this piece ends up being diagonal, provided I have, I can, or at least diagonal in the KK space, in the usual sense, if I have the following relations. And del z, so it should be a minus 2 plus c over z, fn r equals minus fn FNR. Oops, sorry. Okay, so I want these relations plus orthogonality with respect to L0, L1, dz, L0 over z to the fourth, fml, fnl is equal to 0, is equal to the same thing, L1, L1, dz, L0 over z to the fourth, FMR, FNR. OK, so if I satisfy these conditions, the KK structure, the five-dimensional structure, will diagonalize in here. And it will look like essentially a tower of, it will end up looking like a tower of four-dimensional KK modes with local mass MN. In other words, here, if I apply this operator to an FN, which is the part of this is going to act on, if I have an eigenvalue here, I get a mass term here that looks like the usual Dirac mass. And then the similar story goes for here. I get back my usual Dirac mass. So with this, and with this normalization, the KK factors all cancel out, and I get a sum over KK modes. So these are the equations I want to satisfy. There are now two first-order differential equations. With these eigenvalues matching up. And I have some funny normalization condition. So I take this, and I want to solve it. But the tricky part now is that I now have left and right-handed functions. And this differential operator acting on this gives me this differential operator on the right-handed guy. So left, right, right, left. And this is what fermion, this is standard of fermion equations of motion. You get a derivative operator acting on, let's say, a left-handed piece. That gives you a mass term times a right-handed piece and vice versa. So the way to deal with this is, OK, the usual thing, we just take this, plug this relation in here and here, and then turn the crank, and turn this into a pair of first-order differential equations. So the first-order differential equations look a little bit different for the left and right-handed pieces. Del z, L0 over z to the fourth, del z, fn of l is equal to minus mn squared minus c squared plus c minus 6 over z squared. Fn of l. And something similar, a similar thing acting on fn of r gives me minus mn squared minus c squared minus c minus 6 over z squared fn of r. So these are two Sturm-Liouville operators. And I could solve for all this. And given their structure, the eigenfunctions are going to be orthogonal with respect to this, normalizable, and they form a complete set. So this works well. And I can go off and solve this. And OK, so the solutions turn out to be a bunch of Bessel functions. But the most interesting one, the most interesting pieces will be for the zero modes. So if I write down the zero mode solutions corresponding to mn equals to 0, the zero mode solutions are f0 of z, l is equal to a0, z over l0, 2 minus c, and f0r of z is equal to C0, so A0 and C0 are just two normalization factors, 2 plus C. So we can solve these independently, and we get these independent or would be independent zero modes. But now we have to go back and worry about boundary conditions, and also the fact that there's some additional structure in this linear form that's not entirely captured in the two second order forms. So first of all, we want to satisfy this boundary condition. And one way to satisfy it that works very easily is we can choose that either the left-handed fermion field or the right-handed fermion field vanishes on the boundary. So these are two different choices. Suppose we choose to have the right-handed field vanish on the boundary. So if the right-handed field vanishes on the boundary and we apply it to the zero mode function, That means that the zero mode goes to zero if we choose the boundary condition with phi r L0, L1 equals to zero. And similarly, if we chose in a different boundary condition where psi L goes to zero on the boundary condition, we get rid of the left-hand zero mode. And the thing is, to satisfy this, we don't need both of them to vanish. We only need the left-handed piece or the right-handed piece to vanish. So what we can do, and this is how we get chiral fermions, is that to get a chiral fermion, at least at the zero mode level, we use boundary conditions. So you saw this in a form of the tutorial. It goes through here again. So if I wanted to have only a left-handed zero mode, I fix this boundary condition, that leaves this, and I'm done, and vice versa. Now, if I go beyond zero modes, it turns out that the rest of the spectrum is no longer chiral, in the sense that my non-zero mode solutions have the form z over L0 to the 5 halves with some normalization factors, j c plus 1 half mn of z plus bn y c plus 1 half mn of z. Things, Cn j of c minus 1 half. OK, so these are my KK modes. And for these KK modes, even if I force the boundary conditions for either left-handed field or right-handed field to vanish, it turns out that the KK mode profiles don't have to vanish in this case. And the reason for that is that these Bessel functions are oscillatory. So I can have a non-zero profile that still vanishes at both ends, like a sine or a cosine, or in this case, they're Bessel functions. But on top of this, if I go back to my first order form, I also have to have a relation between the left-handed zero mode and the right-handed zero mode for non-zero MN. So for non-zero MN, this consistency condition turns out to give An is equal to Cn, and Bn is equal to Dn. So that means that I get two independent parameters after applying these things that relate left-handed and right-handed modes through the orthogonality condition. So I have this relation from my first order forms, the mixed left and right. And this leaves two things. And now, since I have this, and since I can choose a boundary condition such that one of these has to vanish, one of these profiles has to vanish at the boundaries to satisfy that boundary condition vanishing, this means that I get essentially one condition on the relative normalization. So this is like the condition we had on beta n in the previous case. And to solve this uniformly, this is going to pick out certain values of mn. And this picks out eigenmode, or I guess the eigenvalues, where mn goes roughly like n over L1 in a similar form to before. So again, these fermion KK modes also have a TEV splitting that's roughly even. So I have that. And even if I choose boundary conditions such that I have a chiral zero mode, the KK mode spectrum is non-chiral. So for example, I'll use colorful chalk for this. So the picture is that at the zero level, my spectrum for the left-handed guys is I can have a left-handed zero mode at the zero level, and then I'll have a left-handed KK mode at n equals 1, left-handed KK mode at n equals 2. But if my boundary condition is that the right-handed component has to vanish at the boundary, I have no right-handed zero mode, but I do have right-handed KK modes. So the spectrum is chiral up the KK tower, but it's non-chiral because of the boundary conditions at the lowest level. So we're going to use this in a minute to put the standard model into a warped background spacetime. So OK, this is left, and this is right. So things match up at these levels, but OK, I have a mismatch at the zero mode level. One other thing that I can look at is the normalization of these fields, or the the localization of the fields. And remember, these profiles are localized with respect to L0 over Z. So if I want to see how these things are distributed in the extra dimension, what I should look at to get an idea of the profiles are essentially L0 over Z squared, sorry, to the 3/2. Is that right? It's 3/2. I think it's 3/2. L0 over Z, 3/2, Fn, left, right of Z. And when I do that, and I normalize by this, my KK modes have the same form of Z over L0 with 1 power, after rescaling this way, times Bessel functions. So the KK modes are also localized in the same way as the other things. But my zero modes can either be UV or IR localized. So this thing, for the zero modes, it corresponds to, for the zero left, I would have a Z over L0 to the 1/2 minus C. And my zero right would have a localization of Z over L0, 1/2 plus C. So now C can be positive or negative. But what we see is that these profiles, after rescaling them appropriately, can either be UV localized or IR localized. So if this is a positive power, they're localized towards the IR. If it's a negative power, they're localized towards the UV. And I can tune that UV or IR localization by varying the C coefficient. And now this only applies to the zero modes. All the KK modes are still localized towards the IR. So this is going to have an interesting property in a second. So we have all this technology. We've done KK expansions. Let's next take this background story and put the standard model in it. So the first case, and this is what was originally proposed, is called sometimes minimal RS, or sometimes just RS1. So it's the first thing that Randall and Sundrum proposed. And the idea here is, okay, the story here is pretty simple. Here I've got my L0 brain, my L1 brain, and I put the whole standard model on the IR brain. And that means the only thing in the bulk here is gravity. So the new states are the graviton KK modes. And if I look at the graviton standard model KK couplings, it turns out that when you put in the KK expansions, what you find is a 1 over M Planck coupling between the energy momentum tensor of the standard model, just the usual story, and I get my zero mode, H0 mu nu. So this is my graviton KK function. But when I take into account the normalization factors and so on for everything else, for the KK modes, and I integrate over the extra dimension as an effective theory, I get a rescaling. So this piece corresponds to regular general relativity, in that I have a coupling between the piece that the zero mode, the massless zero mode that I identify with the graviton, with the standard model energy momentum tensor, with strength 1 over M Planck. But I have this extra piece where my KK mode gravitons couple to the standard model energy momentum tensor again. But now I get a rescaling factor. And this rescaling factor means that, recall that L1 over L0 is the warp factor, is e to the pi krc. And this is the thing we chose to rescale between the Planck scale, roughly the Planck scale and the weak scale. So this means that the effective coupling between, between the graviton KK modes and the standard model looks like it has the same form as the gravity coupling, but with a much stronger coefficient. And this comes about because these modes are localized towards the UV, and these modes are localized towards the IR. So instead of having a 1 over M Planck strength coupling, their effective coupling goes like a 1 over M Planck L1 over L0, which is roughly like 1 over TV. So a higher dimensional operator suppressed by 1 over TV size couplings is exactly the kind of thing you can probe at the LHC. So various LHC collaborations have tried to find these KK gravitons. And the way this would come about is I could just have my standard proton-proton collision into a KK graviton mode that would then decay back to standard model states. So my initial state, let's say, could be quark anti-quark. My final state could be, let's say, I don't know, mu anti-mu. So what this would look like is a resonance. This would look like a resonance in the so-called dielectron channel. So in other words, I look for events with pairs of leptons. And when I measure two energetic leptons, I form the so-called lepton invariant mass. The lepton invariant mass corresponds to the sum of the four momenta of these muons that I measure. And this P3 plus P4 squared is equal to the S of the collision. But if I think about the distribution of this dielectron invariant mass, what I'd expect from background is just some falling thing as a function of. So this is the number of events that I see per unit invariant mass bin. So my background looks like this. But if I have an S channel thing here, I'm going to get a resonance as the center mass energy approaches this mass. So this is my background. And then my signal on top of the background would be a resonance on top of this, where I'd have some. So I look for bumps. In this dielectron channel. I can also look in other channels, but the dielectrons are easy to identify experimentally. And these have been looked for. And so far, we have limits on these KK mode masses on the order of a few TeV. Although the exact limit depends on a ratio between K and the Planck scale. So I explained this a bit in my notes. But in any case, this is a viable way to address the hierarchy problem. But there's another realization of putting the standard model in the RS background, which instead has all the standard model fields in the bulk space instead of being confined to the IR brain, except for the Higgs. So we still want to keep the Higgs on the IR brain, or at least very close to it. But you can do interesting things if you also allow the standard model to propagate in the bulk. So I'll call this non-minimal RS. So the picture here is, so again, I have my L0 brain, my UV brain, my IR brain, and here I put the Higgs, but everything else in the standard model lives in the bulk. So I'm going to have my vector bosons, A mu, and I'm going to have fermions for all the standard model states, so pi cube, psi u, and so on for everything else. And this is a nice story. Let's start with the fermions. For the fermions, I would start with something called psi q, and actually this is something you'll work through in the homework. So this thing is going to have a psi q l component and a psi q R component. And if you want to match this up to the standard model left-handed quark doublet, we want a zero mode that's only left-handed. So if we apply this boundary condition, that it vanishes, this piece vanishes here. We only get a left-handed zero mode. And this left-handed zero mode, in the absence of a Higgs, will be exactly massless. And this is exactly what we want to identify with the left-handed quark doublet. So we can do this for Q. But of course, we have three generations. So we should actually do three copies of it. We should do one Q for each thing, for each generation. And then you do the same thing with the say, psi U, the right-handed quark, and the leptons, and this and that, and the down quark, and all that. So for the U, I want a right-handed zero mode, so I use a different boundary condition. But in any case, I have non-chiral KK states plus chiral zero modes. And the chiral zero modes I identify with the standard model states. And for each of these, I'm going to have some coefficient. So I'm going to have some corresponding C sub Q that will set the localization of this of the state. And similarly for U, I'll have a C sub U. And in general, I can have different C coefficients for each generation. The next thing is I have my vector boson zero modes. And again, I can choose a gauge in which the five component vanishes. So I just have I only have to worry about the Lorentz index vector fields. And here I'm going to have zero modes plus KK modes. And my zero modes, at least without the Higgs, the zero modes without the Higgs are going to be massless. Again, like what I want for regular vector bosons in the standard model. But I have this massive tower of KK modes on top of that, which are massless with or without the Higgs. So now I take this story. I can put in all my standard model fields, and I can identify them with zero modes of the bulk states. And then I have the Higgs. And in the usual way, I arrange for the Higgs to get a vacuum expectation value. Now, because of the structure of the fifth extra dimension, my Higgs expectation value is now quantumly stable. And it's going to have some interesting effects. So in the usual way, the Higgs gets a VEV, and we expand around it, and we get a Higgs boson. And we can look at how this Higgs couples to other stuff, and what this Higgs implies for masses and so on. So suppose we look at how the Higgs couples to a set of standard model fermions. So we want to write this Higgs coupling in a way that's consistent with the spacetime structure. And when I put in all the factors of the metric, the thing I would have in the five-dimensional form is something like a psi bar q, psi u, h times delta z minus l1 plus Hermitian conjugate. So this factor of l0 over z to the fifth comes about from the determinant of the g factor of the metric, so the root g piece. So this is just my usual root g. And then this is just a standard Yukawa coupling written now among the bulk fields with some unspecified Yukawa coupling and now a delta function to force the Higgs to live on the IR brain. So this is consistent with our whole structure. And I can take this, and I can plug in my KK modes here. And what's going to happen is I get the KK modes evaluated at the I specifically get the KK modes evaluated at the IR brain. So remember that our choice of boundary conditions is such that, at least applied to the zero modes, the zero mode is non-zero only for the left-handed component of this, and it's non-zero only for the right-handed component of this when I evaluate it on the IR brain. So what this ends up giving me, among other things, is the piece that connects to the piece that connects the zero modes that correspond to the standard model fermions to the Higgs takes the following form. So when I put in all these zero mode profiles and apply the delta function, what I get is and then rescale by this, what I get is an effective Yukawa coupling for the up quark that gets rescaled by the localization factors in the extra dimension. So this is actually a nice way to naturally generate a large hierarchy of Yukawa couplings. So remember, the electron Yukawa coupling is very small. The light quark Yukawa couplings are very small. But the top quark Yukawa couplings order one. So if I have these initial Yukawa couplings in the bulk theory to be kind of order one-ish, just whatever, these are normalization factors fixed by the integration over there. And these things come along from the profiles. So these pieces coincide with how much the wave function of the various zero modes overlaps with the IR brain. And what we can choose, for example, is the intuitive picture of this is that my Higgs lives over here. And if I want something like a top quark to have a big Yukawa, I'm going to want to choose my CQ for the top to live more towards the IR brain. Whereas for the electron or the down quark, I can choose my profiles to live more towards the UV brain. So this is actually a nice picture to get, first of all, a very hierarchical CKM matrix, but also very different Yukawa couplings. So there's this thing. One other comment I want to make, and okay, I'm going to have to wrap up in a minute or two. One other comment I want to make is remember that when we looked at our vector bosons and we looked at their KK profiles, at least to the extent that they're massless, are exactly flat. So this is actually a nice feature because if you think about it, you might worry that, okay, if I'm localizing my fermion zero modes differently in the extra dimension, won't the vector boson modes have different overlaps with them? And is this going to give me different effector charges for the different standard model states? But it turns out that because the massless vector KK mode is exactly flat and everything's normalized right, it's going to have exactly the same overlap with all the fermion zero modes, even if they're localized towards the UV or the IR. So you still get for the gluon or for electromagnetism, which don't have any extra mass, equal couplings to everything. So you have universal electric charges and universal color charges, which you need to be consistent with gauge invariance. On the other hand, for the W and Z vector bosons, their zero modes actually get deformed a little bit by the Higgs bev. They actually get pushed out a little bit. And this actually implies that you get corrections to the way in which the weak vector bosons couple to the different fermions in the standard model. And this puts actually a fairly set of strong constraints on these RS theories. OK, so I think I'm basically out of time. But let me just say a few last closing words. The first is that I haven't talked about the radion mode of the graviton. And it turns out that if you look at fluctuations of this brain with respect to the RS geometry, there's no energy cost to fluctuating this distance with respect to just the basic geometry. And this coincides with the fact that there also exists a radion zero mode that's massless and that has a coupling to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So this thing, this is something we want to fix. And we want to fix because we also want to justify why the separation of the brains is as it is, because that's what's giving us our hierarchy. So it turns out that one way to do this is to put a new bulk scalar that I'll call phi into this bulk space and arrange that it gets vacuum expectation values here and here that are a little bit different. And what that does is that because the field has to have different field values at these different ends, it has to have a non-zero change in its value. And that means it has a gradient energy. And that gradient energy is minimized as the brains start to move apart. On the other hand, if the field also has a bulk mass term, the more the fields move apart, the bigger that mass energy gets. So by putting in an extra bulk scalar with these properties, you can actually get a balance between this gradient energy and this mass energy such that it's minimized for a finite separation of the brains that's a reasonable amount. And it turns out when you do that and you calculate the back reaction on the geometry from this bulk scalar, it also gives a radion a mass. So there's a nice story here. There's also a very nice connection between this RS picture and theories of strong coupling. And the picture is roughly that moving in the extra dimension is like doing a renormalization group flow between the local scale here and the local scale here. And this renormalization group flow corresponds to a theory of some new strongly interacting gauge, or some new gauge force between here and here that's approximately conformal, which means its beta function is zero or almost zero. And the presence of a UV brain and the presence of an IR brain corresponds to a spontaneous breaking of that would-be scale invariance. And these states in the bulk can be understood as being partly composite or partly fundamental with respect to the binding of this new gauge force. In particular, stuff that lives near the UV brain in a well-defined way can be mapped onto, in the gauge theory side, stuff that's mostly fundamental. And stuff that's on the IR side maps onto stuff that's mostly composite. So in this picture, or at least in this dual picture, of a strongly coupled theory that matches up to this, the Higgs comes out as a strongly coupled bound state. So okay, so I've run out of time, but okay, but I hope I've got more in my notes about this. Then I hope you found the course useful. And if you have any questions, please let me know. If you have any questions about stuff in my notes or whatever after the course, feel free to email me. I leave town this afternoon, but I'm happy to field questions. So, thanks.